E ala e, ka la I ka hiki na, I ka moana, ka moana hohonu, pi I ka leva nuu, I ka hiki na, I a ka la, e ala e.
Hallo Herz, schön, dass du eingeschaltet hast. Ich bin Nadine Gerhardt und dieser Podcast ist mein absolutes Herzensprojekt, um dich zu inspirieren auf deinem ganz individuellen Weg zu mehr Fülle, Liebe und Lebensfreude. Aloha Sonnenschein, wie schön, dass du wieder eingeschaltet hast, du heiter bis sonnig. Da Reisen ja aktuell nur eingeschränkt möglich ist, entführe ich dich heute auf die Insel Hawaii, denn ich habe einen ganz wundervollen Interviewgast aus Maui und er selbst stammt aus einer traditionsreichen indigenen Familie und gibt bis heute diese Tradition und all das Wissen weiter. Wir sprechen über unsere spirituellen Wurzeln, über unsere verloren gegangene Verbindung zur Natur und warum es Zeit ist für eine neue Lebensperspektive, um wieder das Wunder des Lebens wahrnehmen zu können. Wir sprechen über die männlichen und weiblichen Qualitäten, über die Macht der Verletzlichkeit und über Vergebung. Wir haben vergessen, dass uns alle ein unsichtbares Band verbindet. Was macht die Sterne strahlend, den Mond leuchtend? Das Gras saftig grün, den Wald duftend, den Flügelschlag eines Schmetterlings so machtvoll, die gelebte Liebe zwischen Menschen so unbeschreiblich schön. All das ist eine unsichtbare Energie, deren Existenz wir weitestgehend vergessen haben. Und dadurch fühlen wir uns getrennt. Wir sehnen uns danach, geliebt zu werden, obwohl sie unsere eigene tiefste Natur ist. Und dass die Erde einen spirituellen Körper besitzt, war unseren Vorfahren schon lange bekannt. Rituale, Musik, Gesänge, Gebete, Praktiken hielten die Welten verbunden. Die obere Welt mit der mittleren und der unteren Welt. Doch als dieses Wissen immer mehr verloren ging, wurde diese Energie allmählich schwerer zugänglich. Als die Welt dann von ihrer Quelle abgeschnitten war, erlangte der Materialismus Zugriff auf unser kollektives Bewusstsein. Und über die Jahrhunderte begannen die Magie der Erde und das Wissen über ihre spirituelle Bedeutung zu schwinden, bis es nur noch in Erinnerung gehalten wurde von Weisheitshütern, indigener Volksgruppen und gewissen spirituellen Traditionen. Das ist der Moment in unserer gegenwärtigen Zivilisation und das ist der Grund, warum wir an einem Punkt stehen, wo eine großflächige Veränderung kommen muss. Unsere Aufgabe ist, den Zugang zu dieser Energie wiederherzustellen. Die Erde ist lebendig und wir Menschen dürfen lernen, uns nicht über die Natur zu stellen, sondern zu erkennen, dass wir ein Teil davon sind. Doch Mutter Erde ruft uns, sie weint zu uns, damit wir uns ihrer heiligen Natur zurückerinnern. Bist du mit deiner Seele tief verbunden, bist du es auch mit der Seele der Erde. Und du spürst den tiefen Schmerz von all den Misshandlungen, die wir Menschen Mutter Erde angetan haben und bis heute tun. Überall auf der Welt erheben sich immer wieder indigene Völker, um der Zerstörung der Natur und der Entweihung ihrer heiligen Stätten Einhalt zu gebieten. So auch die Hawaiianer, die zu mehreren Tausenden seit 2019 am Berg Mauna Kea protestieren, weil auf ihrem allerheiligsten Ort ein 1,4 Milliarden Dollar teures Teleskop gebaut werden soll. Ein Gemeinschaftsprojekt von amerikanischen, chinesischen, japanischen, indischen und kanadischen Wissenschaftsorganisationen. Wir verlieren mehr und mehr den Respekt gegenüber der Seele von Mutter Erde. Der Mauna Kea ist die Seele von Hawaii. Der Ort, an dem sie Kontakt zu ihren Ahnen aufnehmen können. Diese noch sehr angebundenen Menschen spüren nicht nur den Schmerz von Mutter Erde, sondern auch den Schmerz von all den getrennt fühlenden Menschen. Es ist Zeit, Prioritäten zu setzen. Es ist Zeit, unsere Wunden in uns selbst anzuschauen und zu heilen und uns zurückzuerinnern, wo wir herkommen und wer wir sind. Hawaii trägt die Energie des alten Lemurien, des sehr alten, versunkenen Kontinents, auf dem es keine Dualität gab. Die Lemurier lebten in einem Gefühl von Einheit und diese Energie ist auf Hawaii besonders spürbar. Deswegen freue ich mich umso mehr auf das ganz besondere Interview mit Kale Kaale Kai und ich hoffe sehr, dass du einiges mitnehmen kannst. Viel Spaß dabei. Happy welcome Kalika Alikai. I'm so, so happy and feeling blessed that you are here with us. Kali, you are joining us from the island of Maui, from beautiful Hawaii. Good morning for you, good evening for me.
Aloha, hi.
I heard you for the first time on another podcast and I immediately thought I'd like to interview you because you have this very special awakened male energy. Maybe it's the Aloha vibe, I don't know. I know it's very important for you to carry the wisdom of your native Hawaiian ancestors and you're doing such a great job. You are a spiritual activist and you work especially a lot with men in a way of conscious brotherhood. And I'm totally excited that you can tell us a lot more about it. I feel so wanderlust. I never went to Hawaii before and I have such a deep connection to Hawaii, especially to Maui. And I don't know why. Maybe you can tell me more about it because you are the expert and I'm feeling that you live your calling. Would you please like to tell us more about you, about your inspiring culture, your traditions, and the energy of Maui?
I grew up on Molokai with my grandparents. It's another island, and I have family here on Maui too. So I kind of, when I learned a lot of natural life ways, like how to hunt food, you know, tend the land, and then I started to travel. And so when I traveled, living in different countries, I was learning how to assimilate to other cultures. And then when I had graduated to start going to college, I came back home to Hawaii. And that's when my immersion into cultural traditions began. What I think about Hawaii and why it's so special, we're the most isolated island group in the whole world. Out of 25 million square miles of ocean, we're pretty much in the middle. And it's this archipelago that has existed for millions of years. And at a time, in the old time, this is one of the stories the elders have shared, that from the last ice age, the climate and the conditions of the ocean and land were very different. And there were people here already, which is indigenous peoples that have been here and that have traveled here. And so lots of different peoples would migrate and travel to Hawaii and then go back to their original homelands, their ancestral homelands. So when I think about people being called here to Hawaii, there is a specific energy that Hawaii carries for the world. And that energy is seen in the biodiversity that we have here in Hawaii, the many different plants and animals that can exist here, live here, thrive here, and live in harmony here. So not every place in the world has those kinds of conditions where we can support lots of different life. I think that's one of the bigger causes. But then also out here, we are able to navigate with the stars because we have less light pollution and being in the middle of the ocean. So there's a lot of that connection between different constellations and our understanding of astronomy and astrology. So I feel that a lot of people, the past few years have been really called to Maui, and I've been meeting a lot of people in different capacities and realms of understanding that have come into my life. And so it's broadening my experience. And what I aim to do with cultural understanding is to bring our old ways, our traditions into a new way, bridging it so that we can create culture again that feeds the world. So that's where I'm at, but yeah.
What is so special about Maui?
I love this place because of all of the hurt it's endured too. All of the disrespect and desecration, and people take advantage, you know, out here. And so I love Maui too because of that, because I know she's not just something here for us, you know, as humans. It's like she's here for a bigger understanding of the world. I think there's something that has to be earned when you come to a place. It's easy for people that come here to assume that they know what this place is, or they understand Maui immediately. And I don't think that's true, because there's so many people that I see that come here, they don't know how to be here. Like, they don't understand the culture. They don't know aloha. They don't know mahalo. They don't know these ways of being. And so they come and they want to have a piece of whatever this is, rather than letting this place tell them how to be, rather than Mama Maui, you know, claiming them, they want to claim Maui. So that's kind of where I come from a lot with people's understanding that, you know, if I have someone that comes to visit Maui and they love Maui so much and they're like, I want to start a yoga studio, or I want to do this, or what, I ask them, like, what do you know about this place? Do you know which plants are medicine? Do you know how to grow plant? Do you know which animals are around here? Do you know how to read the stars? Do you know how to be in the ocean? Do you know where the rivers are? Do you know how, you know? Like, I have so much more questions about why than you should. Like, just because we can doesn't mean we should. So there's a place, I think what a great learning is for Maui, for the world, is limitations and respecting boundaries. Because our environment, the ecosystem is so fragile here. You know, you do something up on the mountain, it's going to affect everything below it. And it'll be seen immediately. Like, where other places, the effects have gone on for so long, it's hardly noticeable anymore. But out here, we notice it. Like Mauna Kea, you know, Mauna Kea on Big Island. Our sacred mountains, it's the pico of our islands, or like the center, one of the chakras. And a lot of people attribute Mauna Kea as being one of the, like, the heart chakra of the world. When you have people who want to come and build telescopes on there or desecrate that land without even knowing the people or understanding the culture, I mean, I don't know where the love is.
Yeah, I heard about it. And now they have the telescope up there, right?
Yeah, they already have telescopes up there. And a lot of it is because it's a pursuit of a understanding of society that is always projecting themselves outward towards the future, towards something that doesn't necessarily exist yet. And by doing that, they're not able to see what's really here, to honor and respect what already is here. So they look at it as being an inability for them to understand the universe, but it's not. It's everything we need to understand is already here. Like, we've been brought here on this planet to live in existence, not to project ourselves outward away from this so that we become disembodied. So much of our hurts and pains in this society is because we become disembodied. We don't know how to connect to ourselves, to have relationships, to hold each other, to be in ways to hold space with each other, so that the things that are burdening us or making us feel anxious or fear or afraid, we don't have people there to help open us up. Instead, we have, you know, academics, or we have realms of psychology, but we don't have culture. You know, we don't have a culture that helps us. So, yeah.
What do you think? Why are the people so disconnected?
I believe there's many ways to understand how that comes about, but I believe that a lot of the disconnection appears in societies where they put themselves above everything else. So if you have a human society and they're in the natural world and they say, all of this is here for me. This is meant for me to live and survive and to live how I see fit, like my image of being alive. That already is a disconnection. That already is saying, I don't recognize anything here. I don't recognize any of these plants or trees or animals or rocks, because they are just part of my reality. There isn't an understanding of the reality that they're existing in. That a story like where we come from, you know, as Kanaka Maoli, like indigenous peoples, we have many different creation stories. And one creation story is we have the names of Wakea and Papa. And this is grandfather sky, grandmother earth, great, great grandparents. And they come into a union with each other. And from that union, they have a baby, but the baby is stillborn and kind of look like a plant more than anything. So they bury this baby in the east side of their house. And in their grief, they cry and waters the ground. So the two of them, this is a short story, it's a long story, but the two of them unify again. They have another child. This child is a human, a baby human. And they call to this child to take care of their older sibling, because as that child is born, so too is a plant. So they tell this child to take care of their older sibling, which is a plant. And the name for the plant is Ha Loa, Nakalau Kapalili. And Ha is in the word Aloha, is the exhale, the breath of life, the ha. And the aloe is the presence, like the face is the front, the time and space that you occupy, this is your aloe. So the aloha is a recognition of the life breath that we exchange, that we share in the world together. And that's for plants, animals, and minerals too, not just human. So haloa is the long breath of life. So this plant we call taro or kalo, we can continue to plant this plant over and over. You can cut the leaves off and cut the corm and you'll have a julian. You can plant over and over and over. It'll grow. So that creation story tells human beings where they're at. Your orientation is like fifth on the list. First you have the sky and the earth, and you have elements like rain, and then you have a plant, and then you have a person. So people can stay connected to all of those things when they have a creation story or a mythos that engages them to have connection, to know that they are just one small piece of a bigger story, that they are just one little like unnecessary thing that can bring beauty into the world. Like that's how human beings are able to understand each other, because the world doesn't need us. We need the world. If we weren't around, if all of our societies were gone and everything was gone, the world would still function without us. But yes, the world wouldn't function the same without bees or bugs or worms, you know, or birds. But I think people become disconnected because they don't see what's really in front of them, because they weren't ever told how. They weren't ever explained or given a culture that says that. What I see in modern societal culture in the West here, because this is still a state of the United States of America, Hawaii, what I see is people's constant search for comfort, convenience, instant gratification, everything at their fingertip so that they can have what they desire, what they want, rather than what they need. And so it creates a distortion that people aren't able to be here. And that's part of my work. My work is to do that, is to like take people out into these natural places and see how much they don't know. Because so many people are like willfully ignorant to that. That they think they know something. So when I bring them into a place, I say, here's a leaf. This is how we work with this leaf. They don't know how, because they've never touched a leaf, yet they know what a tree is, but they've never touched a leaf. Like, I don't know, like, how much do you know the tree? So these are things that I think about regularly.
I live in Frankfurt, you know, and here's a lot about money and higher and faster and everything like that. And right now at the pandemic, a lot of people need to wear masks and you can't do anything. And also in the nature in Frankfurt, if you go into a park, you need to wear mask. And the feeling is like the whole country has collective psychosis. And one of the best-selling drugs is currently antidepressants. And I come from shadow work, and we both know what that means. They suppress the feelings even more. Do you also have in your culture shadow work?
Yes. Yeah. There's remedies there with like what we call shadow work. So it's interesting because since I've been involved with Sacred Sons and learning like the men's work, as it's being called, and going to shadow work, I've been introduced to a lot of these different understandings of like archetypes and psychological terms that I wasn't really familiar with, because I had come from a traditional background and understanding. So when we do shadow work, it's normally through ceremonial and ritualistic ways. So it's a process that takes days, you know, to move through. And that involves like a routine, getting the person into right relationship with nature first, and then giving them the space to like delve deeply into their traumas. And that way of going is a much longer, tender process that is grounded in a culture. So for me to explain it in another context of like how you would understand shadow work as how we're being taught or how we read about or that we practice, it's not the same in an indigenous or native culture. So, like, for example, you hear the word ho'oponopono, right? And Ho'oponopono is a word that we use. However, it's turned into a form of like therapy or methodology for therapy. And the language of like, I'm sorry, I love you, please forgive me, thank you, as a mantra, that's not anything that we actually practice here as Native people. Like, that's not what we do. And we never had that. Like, because what had happened was it was taken from us by other people, and they created a 12-step program, you know, on how to do Hawaiian healing. And that's, it's not real for us because we never did that. In my family, we didn't practice Ho'oponopono that way. We knew the word, we knew the process, like, of the exchange or the reciprocity, but it didn't exist in the way that it's being learned in the world. So for me, I don't mix the two in that way. I have experienced Ho'oponopono in my own family because of the way that we did it through our traditions. But I don't know what a Ho'oponopono practitioner does into what I've experienced within my family and what I've been taught. So that's the other part of shadow work.
How do you practice forgiveness?
We don't call it Ho'oponopono because Ho'oponopono is the word, right? Mm-hmm. So it's like ho'o is like to do or to make. It's an action. Like, I can ho'o'i kaika kokin, or like make my body stronger. I can do that. I can ho'o'olai na honua. Like, I can give more life to the world. But then pono means to be in balance. Pono means harmony. That's what it means. It means authenticity. When something is pono, it means it's balanced, it has harmony, therefore authenticity can come through. So it's pono. So if you say pono pono, what you're doing is you're saying that this thing is not only harmonious and balanced, but it is also in a form to help and be and give to other that. Ho'o pono pono. So it's a similar way of like saying vai. Like in our language of vai, it means fresh water. You say vai vai, it means wealthy. It's not just fresh water. It's fresh water that is abundant, can give more. And it means wealthy because water is what gives life to all things. Without water, there would be no life here on this planet. So we need water. That is the true wealth, to have the water of life, the life-giving water. So when we do Ho'oponopono as a family, each family look different, but it's held with elders, you see? Each family, it looks different. Each family has a matriarch or a patriarch, a leading elder that is male or female. And their understanding of the relationships of the people is because everyone is related. It's done within the family. It's if you have issue between cousins, sisters, brothers, siblings, uncles, aunties, parents, however it may look, you know, children, the elders are able to communicate about the problem, and then they come together. They communicate to each other, they hold space for the family. And then the family comes and they have to express their hurts and their pains, or the distortion or the miscommunication, the misunderstanding before the other families. They have to express it. And then everyone is able to understand the situation and come with intention to help heal and remedy whatever that is. So it wasn't relying upon any one person, like a therapist or psychologist or a Ho'oponopono practitioner. It was something that the ohana was able to do. So it's not a prescribed way. It was just different because the culture held us. It was the foundation that we all came from. And also our language. You know, we speak English right now. And we speak Hawaiian. It'd be a totally different worldview that we'd be engaging with. Similarly with German, you know. Mm-hmm. Like if we were speaking German, especially really old, like poetic German, we would be speaking a whole nother level of expression and of language, of meaning and depth that is beautiful, you know? Mm-hmm. So English, we have to do the same. So Ho'oponopono and those things need to engage language differently.
I heard Hawaiian is a language of the heart. Is that true?
Yeah, I like, so when we speak in Hawaiian, we are using, like in English, we go A, E, I, O, U. In Hawaiian, we go a, e, I, o, u. And there's ways of that simplicity of, if I can say it like just that means life springs forth. Like there is life there, like like there's life. It's like if you ever, you have an altar and you put food on the altar and you leave it there, the food starts to spoil and you start to see bugs come and they appear. That's that means the God is present. Like life has shown, life on top of life. Or like when you make bread, right? Flour, yeast, water, you mix it together and then it starts to rise, like create more food. That's ah, like, wow, incredible. Mm. It's a miracle. So that's ah, just in that word. And eh, a whole nother one, e, like creator, supreme, o, u. So when we talk about it being in the language of the heart, it's because there's an articulation that's going with your tongue, which mm-hmm. is the thumb of the mouth. Mm-hmm. So when you're able to speak in beautiful ways and you're coming from the heart, Hawaiian is much easier to do that. Mm-hmm. Because within every word, there is something amazing, like vai. Vai, W-A-I. If you separate the words wa and e, like wa means like a time or era or epoch. This is the wa. This is a time of an era. And then e is creator or supreme, one that creates, the high one, most high. That word means water. So poetically, it's saying water is memory. Water is the timeline. Water is time, like a river of time, a stream of consciousness from creator. So just saying that word engages you in a different way. You're not in your head because it doesn't exist. There's no rationality. Everything defies logic in the Hawaiian language because it's contextual. And so when you're really feeling and you're in deep in your emotion and you're coming from your heart place, when you speak Hawaiian, yes, you're coming from the heart because it's real, because it's not something that you're creating out of an illusion of your own ability to speak. You're coming back into nature. And you're coming back into the way that we're able to be informed by our places so that we may have language. And that's why it's so old, like being able to say, ah, like, you know, it's like old, like primate kind of language. Like, even though we're humans, we are able to learn language because of what everybody else was doing around us. Like flutes. Flutes didn't come about because we had a great idea. It was because we saw that there was plants in nature that was taking on the wind. Or we heard birds and they were able to sing in such a way, we wanted to mimic it. You see what I mean? Mm-hmm. So that's the language of the heart. The language of the heart is our ability to communicate to other beings that are in relationship with us and that love us too. So if you have a language that, like with English, you know, we have more words for paper than we do for waves. You know, we have more words for things that we don't like, for like ailments or illnesses or diseases, than we do for love. What's happening? You know, we're speaking this way about sickness and illness in such a complicated and sophisticated way, but we don't even know more words for healing or more words for love and the depth of those things. So yeah. So yes, Hawaiian is the language of the heart.
Beautiful. What indigenous ceremonies you have?
We have plenty. The way that I live my life is in ritual every day. Waking up in the morning and greeting the sun. Very simple, you know, everyone can do. Same thing with saying farewell to the sun, you know, during sunset, evening time. Ceremonially, in deeper ways, it's the rituals that lead you to the ceremony. Yeah, the ritual is the daily practice, the living practice, so that when you do enter ceremony, you know how to be in that. So the ceremonies that I do for people is normally like sweat lodge, ava, water ceremony, sound ceremonies, hula, chant. So there's a lot of different ones that I do. Also like star navigation, understanding different houses. But yeah, there's many. And there's certain ways too of being with that. So like we have what we call cultural schools here in Hawaii. They're called halau. So cultural schools are halau. I'm in halau. If you're a cultural practitioner, you should be in a halau. You should have a teacher or a kumu. And most of them, they will teach hula and music and chant. But the halau that I'm a part of, we learn like high ceremony and how to praise the sacred and how to repair the damages of human impact. When you are part of halau, you are able to go through a different learning journey or a deepening of your own relationship to the world around you and to multi-generational people. So that's a family. So when ceremony does come, you know exactly where you need to be able to do. You know when it's your turn to speak, you know when it's not time to speak, you know what to do to support, you know, who to help, you know, who to look for. So I think sometimes we get so, in this society, in Western society, we get so quick to want to be a part of ceremony because we've been missing it in our whole life. You know, many people have not had ceremony. Yes. So they're so eager, like too eager, mm-hmm. and they overestimate themselves about doing it. And for example, I had, I was out there in San Diego Liberty Arising for a gathering with the Sacred Sons. And then there was a man there, and he had been to Aotearoa, to New Zealand, and he's been to Hawaii before, and he's gone and met a lot of different indigenous people. And so then he began to ask me about Ho'oponopono and how he could learn. And then I just remember looking at him and asking him, it was like, for what? You know, why? And he said, oh, because my wife feels called to learn, and we love Hawaii and this and that. So I had to tell him, I said, you know, as much as you're making these connections with indigenous people, and as much as you feel called to this work, you have to remind yourself, are you just collecting ceremonies like seashells on a beach, going up to a mountain and just taking rocks because you feel called to it? Like, what is it that you're really doing? Are you just collecting indigenous ways so that you feel better about what you've been missing? That the thing that you did not have, that somehow you want to gather up as much of it as you can. And I'd be very careful of that. Just being a part of one thing is enough. Learning everything about one thing is enough. And if you feel called to move through more things, especially as a person who's not of that culture, what's really happening? Is it another form of colonization? Is it? Or are you actually surrendering yourself to what's being asked of you from these traditions, from these people, from these cultures, from these life ways? Like, what's being asked of you? So that's where I'm at with ceremonies. Mm-hmm. Start people off small. You know? Doesn't always have to be the big thing. Like, go do plant medicine, go do ayahuasca, bufo, or combo, or, you know, like, oh, I gotta have all of this. Like, no, just need to stop. Take your paces. Look at the bird. How many tail feathers does a songbird have? You know, how many tail feathers does a talon bird have? 12. You know, many people don't know. Do you know how to walk across the river before you become a shaman? You know, do you know how to work with the plant? Do you know how to make gifts? You know how to gift people? You know, beautiful thing. Like, do you know how to teach them how to live without you? Can you teach people how to live without you so they don't depend on you? Can you do that? No, you don't know how? Then maybe being a medicine person isn't for you. You know, maybe you should wait and learn. So that's why I have to explain to people too, because just so much accessibility and so much like the pandemic, like you were bringing up. It's like good reset.
Really, really interesting.
Like, because I hold two traditions. So I have Kanaka Maoli, which is the Hawaiian understanding. Mm-hmm. And then I also have Native American, which is Dakota or Oyate. So they're very different. Very, very, very different. One is more embracing and open and compassionate and loving, also very warrior, very strong, but also balanced in that approach. Like, this is how it looks. So let's be more tender and gentle. And then when we can be a little bit more aggressive and a little bit quicker. The other way that my lineage is in is a continual sacrifice. Everything must be sacrificed in order for you to really awaken to creator and to spirit. As a man, it demands of you more to give out than to what you receive. So as a man in those cultures, you are being prepared to give up everything for your people and to be guarded when other people try to come in. So it's two very different ways. So their ceremonies look very different.
I know. You have a very great voice.
Oh.
I heard you.
Do you also chant a lot?
Yes. Yeah. I chant a lot. Chant every day.
Do you have something for us?
this is a good one for the sun. This is one that people can look up to, but they can hear it with my voice. And it talks about e'ala'e. Which means like to awaken or to arise. It also means a path. And it's talking about the sun as a living being. like the sun has like their own journey, their own journey through the sky. The sun too has to awaken and arise and has to go on their journey, on their path for the day. And coming from the deep, deep ocean all the way up to the highest points of the atmosphere, you know, to that part of the bridging between worlds. It's like the sun is that, is the one that walks that, that, that path, that boundary. And it's asking for us as human beings to awaken that divine light within us. The source of radiance, the source radiance within us, within our hearts, and like awaken and arise. As we believe that we have to wake up more than once out here. Like waking up from your bed physically is one thing, waking up emotionally and spiritually and all those other things. They're not separate, but
yes, sometimes,
but people need that. And it goes like this. This song is chanted before the sun rises. So you wake up before the sun rises, make your tea, make your coffee, whatever you drink, and get into a meditative place. And then once you start to see just a little peeking of the sun over wherever you're at, over the trees or the horizon or the mountain or the valley, wherever you stay, and then you begin to chant. So you might be chanting this chant over and over for, you know, 15, 20 minutes.
Thank you so much. What are your daily rituals?
Typically, I wake up in the morning, have a brief meditation, greet the sun, and I'll go work out, and then I'll go into the studio and make music and practice. And then, yeah, it's pretty much my routine. So as long as I get all of that in the day, everything else that I do later, I mean, do all of that in the morning, everything else that I do later then is just bonus. So the ritualistic way of living in a modern life is so important to bring us back to, like an indigenous soul. So that's where we've gotten lost, is that we've turned our rituals into something that looks like answering emails. You know, or like, taking care of the bills, or like getting ready for work. You know what I mean? Like your ritual is to get ready for your commute and for work, rather than the ritual being getting ready for the world, like for the day, for the energies that are going to come through, for the elements that you get to enjoy, like lights, you know, like fire, electricity. Like nobody's doing that.
Yeah.
You know, not nobody, but the vast majority of people are not. So having the time to ritual, it can look like pulling from your divination card deck, you know, reading, tapping in, quick meditation, thank you, reflect upon, go outside in whatever capacity, the park, the garden, tap into that, come back home, move your body, breathe, movement and breath, real simple, and just do that. And then you can go off into the day, and then you can go to work, and then you can take care of the family, and then you can take care of other people, because you have emotionally centered yourself. You have spiritually brought yourself intact, that now you're channeling. You're not just a person walking around like unconsciously, like you're awake. So everything around you will respond. You are consciously creating your reality. And everything will respond to you as you respond to them. If you think of yourself as just only one thing, then it's hard for anything else to approach you, because you're so fixed in your understanding of yourself. So if you only think of yourself as the employee, then you'll always be the employee. And it'll be hard to reach to you as who you really are. Who are you really? So one of the rituals I like to do is to look in the mirror and ask yourself, like, who are you? Who are you? What are you doing? Where are you going? Where are you from? Who's with you? Who loves you? Who do you love? What are you grateful for? Who's grateful for you? You know, just things to ask yourself. And sometimes you'll be surprised by the answer. You know, if someone feels very saddened about the state of their life at the moment, you know, it's hard for them to think of who loves them. It's hard to think of what they're grateful for, because they're so sad. They're so depressed. You know, and so it's good, because then it helps you check in, because then now you know, oh shoot, I need help. I can't do it all by myself. I don't know who loves me right now. reach out, call someone, you know, reach out, speak to somebody. If you don't ask you those questions and you go on so long, flatlining, and you suppress all that emotion and you got the antidepressants and you're just taking all the pills, and the real ritualistic thing, the old ways are not that foreign. They're really like tapping into your breath and moving your body and having gratitude for things outside of yourself. It's like when we start to really like cave ourselves in and look at all the stuff that had happened in the past or what we've done and what we regret or feel guilt or shame over, those things haunt us. They haunt us, and then they keep us isolated into our own egos, and we get wrapped up into what's going on in here rather than feeling everything from the top of your head to the bottom of your feet and expressing it outward, sharing outward.
Here in Germany, most people do not feel connected to their ancestors. We live in a very mind-driven country here, and that is often dismissed. Furthermore, if you go back one or two generations, depending on how old you are, there were the two world wars, and a lot of suffering and pain, which is passed on unconsciously for generations. But which people don't like to talk about, and maybe they are also afraid about it. It was a time when it was a matter of survival and you couldn't worry about your calling. If you ask around, most of them maybe know a little bit about their grandparents, but their great grandparents or great-great-grandparent, they know nothing. But behind all the pain, there's also a lot of untapped potential. But they haven't learned to honor their ancestors. For me, if you can't honor your ancestors, there's no way to self-love, because everything on or in you is a result of your ancestors. How about the Hawaiian culture? Do you consciously connect with your ancestors every day?
Yeah, I feel like when we talk about ancestors, there should be an understanding too of that. For myself, there not everyone that has come before us dreamed of us. Not everybody did that. Some ancestors really dreamt of us coming. They thought of us, of this generation. They really thought about us and they cared about us before we even showed up. And they did certain things so that we would know that they cared. And there's that available to each and every single person on this planet, that someone has thought of them. It's true. It really is like in the entirety of ancestral timeline or lineage or heritage or genealogy. Because I say that because I'm a person that thinks that way. I'm a person that dreams of those coming. And I think of what I must do for them as what I have experienced in my own life or what others have experienced and they've shared with me. You know, I wasn't there for the wars. I've never participated in a war. I know there's war going on because of American imperialism. And I know the effects of it, yet it doesn't stop me from dreaming about those to come and what it is that I can do in my life. So I'm a living ancestor. So when I think about peoples that feel a certain way, like in Germany, about their own ancestry and they feel shame or guilt by it, I can understand, because there are certain things that have happened that have caused it to be this way. Yet you are alive now and you still have dreams and you still have visions and you still have language. You still have a people around you. You still have a lot so that you can do what is necessary now for those yet to come, that you can do and be that which you needed when you were younger. And then that will then give the abundance back to where it belongs, to those that are coming, so that they can then carry it on. And so that's only what I tell people in short about ancestral connection. Do I connect to my ancestors? Yes, but not all of them are helpful too. Some of them are ones that I need to heal through myself in order for them to move through into the next stage. Not all ancestors are happy. Not all of them. And not all of them are supportive either. You know, And that's because there's things that we need to remedy and metabolize here right now with each other to help them release so they can move. Because a lot of things that we inherit are traumas, but a lot of things that we inherit are gifts too. Really big, beautiful gifts. And in order for us to move through things like shadow work, I trust someone that can do shadow work with me if they have gone to those places too, or they have at least experienced it. If you have somebody who is a recovering addict, or you have somebody who is a recovered addict, although the addiction is always there, but they know how to move and deal with it, they can approach somebody else who has had addictions too much easier, you know, than somebody who hasn't. Mm-hmm. Similarly with me, with ancestral connection and with culture, it's what I've dedicated my life to. So it's much more appropriate and in alignment for someone like me to meet someone else that is doing that for themselves too. Mm-hmm. That I can meet them where they're at with it. So the shame and the guilt and the resentment, it's part of everything. It shows up, but it's not necessary to function. Like, it's something that indicates you of what is happening and you can respond to it and change, but it's not a place to function from. It's not an orientation to be in. So yeah, ancestral connection is important to know by way of your communication, to commune with them, to come together, to share something. So when I go out and I create a lei or a kupe'e or an offering, a makana, a gift, I communicate to my ancestors. I talk to them. I'm not worshiping them. I'm talking to them. And I'm letting them remember, like, I haven't forgotten. I remember you. I am your grandchild. I am here. I'm speaking with you. Please talk with me. And then I give them a gift. And then I pray to Creator. I pray to the gods and the goddesses. That's who I pray and I worship. It's not people. I don't worship people. The legacy isn't about what people are creating. It's about what we're doing for this planet. That's the real legacy to me. Yeah. So the Germany thing is a very, is hard. That one hits the heart a lot.
Yeah.
Yet that's one legacy of a nation. When everything else is much bigger than that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm out here in Hawaii. Like, I want this world, not just Hawaii, to thrive and to prosper. I want the whole world to prosper. So I'm not concerned with American ideals or values.
Yeah.
Or American shame, mm-hmm. or resentment or atrocities. Like, I'm not concerned with that. America has a lot of things that they've done. Terrible, horrendous things.
Right.
But the world doesn't treat America the same. So to me, I was like, it's ridiculous. I don't involve in it. Like, I don't see myself as an American citizen. I don't see myself as being a part of any of that. I see myself as who I am, where I'm at, with what matters most.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the natural world, mm-hmm. in my relationships.
What does respect and mindfulness means for Hawaiians?
It means everything. It means everything. Mm-hmm. A lot of times people say aloha is like the value that we hold most here in Hawaii. I would argue that. I would say that aloha is an action. It's a way of life. It's something that you do. You know, it's not just like this word that you shared. And aloha can mean many things: love, compassion, empathy, grace. It can be a poetic saying of an understanding of the depth of knowing that you have a mindfulness of life that's around you, that's sharing with you. So mindfulness is in aloha too. But I would say for our people, because of our culture and our traditions and our lineage, one of the primary values that we would have is ho'okela, which means to pursue excellence.
Mm-hmm.
It's to pursue excellence. And when something is excellent, it's not just that you're good at it or you've mastered it. It's not that. It's that you've created a relationship that you are enhanced, and so is whatever that you are with.
Mm-hmm.
So that pursuit of excellence is like, how deeply do I know myself, and do I have respect for myself? If I can respect myself deeply, then I can respect everything else around me. So that's really important, because without respect for yourself, it's hard to reach for your own excellence. It's hard to reach for this place of refinement and sophistication. and also honoring, right? Honoring yourself. How do you honor things? It's important to have both praise and grief at the same time. That's how you honor something. You praise something because it is with you, and you don't know how long you'll have that with you. And then when it's gone, you grieve it because it meant something to you and it was important and it mattered so much. So you give tears in recognition. But then even when you're praising something and you're laughing and you're crying, it's the same. The tears that come from your face are relatives, whether it's in a smile or a frown. It's like, you still cry. So that's the beauty of the honoring. That's how you honor. You praise and you grieve, you honor and you respect, you keep your word, ho'okela, you reach for excellence. All of these things are embodied, right? Mindfulness, respect. Our understandings and our culture and our teachings help people to come back into their heart center. Not to just be mindful, but to be embodied. Yeah, and not to be concerned with comfort, but safety. That you're able to go to these edges and cross over them or jump over them, whatever they may be, fall from them, be embraced by them, and feel safe. You know that you can do it and that you'll make it out. You'll make it out alive. You might come in with a couple, come out with a couple bruises or nicks or tears or whatever, but you're alive and you've learned something and now you're reaching towards your excellence. Ho'okela. And it's happening because we have people around you that are pono. They're balanced. They're harmonious. They're in alignment. They're good. And they have aloha. They're compassionate. They're empathetic. You know, and they're also real ma'a. They understand. They have a good understanding and familiarity. Mm-hmm. So mindfulness, respect, honor, praise, grief, embodiment. All of these things are learned by way of culture. And maybe that's why we don't know it so well in our Western societies, because we don't learn how to be human in the school, or how to love the sacred in school.
What is the most important gift you learned from your lineage?
I don't think there is any one. I think what I can say though
mm-hmm.
is what culture has done for me and what my lineage has done for me is that it's helped me learn how to hold different realities at the same time. So I can function as a modern person in Western society, and I know what that looks like and I know how to be with that. But then I also have my cultural understanding of myself, so I know how to be with that too. So I can hold different realities at the same time. So when I look at something, I'm not just looking at that as like one version. I see multiple versions.
Wow.
And what that means, you look at a star, and in one way that star is called Sirius, right? Or in our language it's called A'a. And I know that star in one context that says, oh, this is an astronomical understanding of what this star is and where and what kind of star it is. And then I also know in my cultural context, this is the star that helps lead us to these islands over here. This is the star that shows up at this time, of the cycle that we're traveling around the sun. This is the star that some of our relatives say that they are from, star seeds that have come from there. So I can hold those realities. So that's been one of the more important presents and gifts of my lineage is that. And all of our lineages have this. That's the thing. Even the indigenous peoples of Germany, of that land, there was a lot of ancient wisdom there too.
Yes.
And so when I think about, most important of gifts that you could receive from your lineage is being able to learn how to belong, how to be at home, how to care for a home, how a place claims you, how to be claimed by a place, how to be based in your places, of the places that hold you. That's what cultures are meant to do, to help people be embodying respect and honor and all those things. So
yeah, wow.
It's important.
Mm-hmm.
What's your feeling? What's the most important medicine for men?
I think for men, it's really important for them to feel their feelings, to really feel their feelings and move through them in a way that they can be witnessed by other men. That's some of the most important work for us. I think a lot of what has happened when we talk about environmentalism and when we talk about injustices like civil rights, it has happened because of men. Men that have not learned how to feel. Men that have not learned how to be in relationship, how to be courteous and considerate to the sacred, how to respect and honor where they come from. And so the way that they can do that is by suppressing all those feelings and emotions that connect them to all of that. And to go into the head as a rational person. Like, this is rational. This is logical. This is how you do. It's like, that is what's creating men in a way that they sever their connection and they cut their vocal cords off from themselves because they don't know how to attach their head to their heart. They don't know how to let their heart live in the body and express. So when I'm able to work with men in those spaces, in those capacities, mm-hmm. just to see them be able to touch the sensitivity, the wounds that they have in themselves, these scars on their soul, when they touch, help them to like really hold themselves again. That inner child, that shadow that they need to like have a closer relationship with rather than pushing away, things like that. And then men will start to open up and then they start to realize like, it's okay to cry. It's okay to love. It's okay to be frail or vulnerable, fragile. It's okay not to want to do it anymore. It's okay to stop. No, it's what you need. You need to just stop and cry. Well, I've been doing everything that I can so that this will work and that I need this to happen. I need to achieve and be successful and I need to make the money because people depend on me. And it, like, it just goes on and on and on. And it's like, well, you've done all these things and how do you feel? It sucks. I don't like this. Then maybe you should stop. But I'm doing everything I can not to stop. I know. That's why you need to. Just stop.
Yeah.
And breathe and cry. So I think that's one of the most important works for men,
mm-hmm.
is to tap into the emotional body much more around other men, especially so that they can learn how to be with that, because it's really other men that are stopping them from doing it. I mean, how many men have grown up, little boys being told not to cry?
Yes.
Don't feel that. That's for girls. And then they demean girls and women by doing that, belittle them, insult them, you know? And so we get ingrained with that as men, like, oh, you don't cry. That's for weak people. That's for all the people that I'm supposed to be like above, like the authority over. Like, this is why the environment is suffering. This is why our women are suffering. This is why there's slavery. You know, there's all those things. So men like me and other men like me, because there's a lot of us out there now, that's what we're doing. We're doing that work. We've done it for ourselves. We continue to do it for ourselves and for each other. And we go to other men and we say, hey, this has got to stop, because it's men that are doing it. So it must take other men to help.
Right.
Men have to protect. Yeah. And men have to be able to turn from being a predator to a protector, turn from, you know, being an instigator or like a victimizer, you know,
mm-hmm.
to being a helper, a supporter.
Mm-hmm.
Someone worthy to be leaned on, someone to be expressed in different ways. That, you know, we're creating that right now. There isn't a lot of ways on how to do that other than indigenous cultures. Because a lot of indigenous cultures and life ways teach us how to move in a new way, gathering from the old new way. So.
How important is vulnerability, especially for men?
I believe for each man, depending on where they're at, some men can lead, some men are not ready to lead, some men need to be groomed on how to lead. But I believe that in the way that we are in this society, men need to lead with vulnerability. Vulnerability needs to be shown first. That's because I believe that we need to invite men to vulnerability, and they will not be invited into that vulnerability if you yourself are not vulnerable. So for example, like for me, this is a reflection I get from a lot of men too. When they see me, they are intimidated by me. They intimidated because they see like I got tattoos and like I look this way and I have a certain look, you know. Yeah, and then they intimidate. Mm-hmm. They're like, oh, this man's scary, or this man is not going to like me, or this man's like a warrior, so I don't want to mess with him. Mm-hmm. And so then when they see me, they have that immediate like projection, like judgment.
Wow.
And so then when they start to watch me, because now they really observant of what I'm doing, because already they're like, oh, that, like in a male psyche, like, oh, somebody like careful. So they're watching, you know. And what they'll see is that I will cry and I will break down when I hear people's story, because it hurts. Mm. It hurts me because I feel very empathetic. And because I am so embodied, when I hear a story about someone suffering, it hurts me. And then I cry. And then they see that. And they're like, oh, he's crying. Like, wow. Like, I can cry too now. Because they were able to see someone do it. Especially someone that they felt scared of or intimidated by. So when they see that crying, they're learning how to cry by watching me. Because they never seen before. They might have seen it in a movie, but they never saw it in real life. And when they see someone like me in real life cry and the tears are falling, then they start to think like, wow, I should have known, you know, that he would cry too. So vulnerability is important, because the vulnerability is that we are taught growing up as little boys to be the knights in shining armor and to go save the day. You know, and if that's the only story you're functioning from and learning about yourself as a boy, you hold a lot of expectations on yourself about what that looks like to be a savior, to be a hero, to be all of these great grandiose things, rather than just being a regular man, common man, just be a regular man. You know, you can be a human being first and a common man and learn how to do that really, really well. And then you can be someone's hero. You know, whoever that may be, but you don't have to be everybody's hero. You don't always have to keep it all together all the time. So fall to pieces. And that's the vulnerability. That's why I tell men too, it's like, be so willing to know that whatever you do, love has a true cost. Then the true cost is not having that love anymore. So you better love strong and passionately and unafraid. And so in love with yourself and with everything around you that it is worth the risk of not having that anymore, for it no longer existing in your life. And you have to love that way. And so when you do, you will cry when other people cry, because you can't help it, because it feels so, so true. I don't believe in truths or like personal truths or anything like that, but I know what is true. And it doesn't come from whatever I'm saying or thinking. It's from outside of myself. And then you find what is true. Because just as any truth that you might have, the very opposite of it is just as true. Just as true. Mm. So vulnerability is key.
What do you believe? What are the biggest problems in intimate relationships?
Communication. Clear, transparent communication. I feel like when it comes to, and this is just how I feel right now today. If you ask me this question tomorrow, I'd probably say something else. But today, this is what it sounds like. I believe like in intimate relationships, the communication between the two people is key, and transparency. And sometimes being direct is a good way, but then also kind of working together on finding a deeper understanding of one another. I think intimacy, especially with couples that have been together for however long, they start to build up different kind of resentments or shame towards each other because of certain things that have happened. Or they are putting up an image of themselves for this person because they want them to stick around, because they love them and they like them and they believe that there's some kind of dependency there that they need to continue to cultivate. So they'll hide certain parts of themselves to keep them around. Eventually that will turn into shame, guilt, resentment, and mm-hmm. the inability to communicate effectively.
Mm-hmm.
So I think being clear and direct and transparent, meaning like, especially in intimate relationships, like what is it that you genuinely find curiosity in, and would you want to explore that with me? Just having that conversation between people is really difficult because they never knew how to do that. They never seen their parents have conversations about intimacy with each other. And most times because of things like religion or belief systems, it's suppressed, intimacy and sexuality. So we live in a touch-deprived society, and wearing masks and everything else is getting worse. I have to be more clear with my relationships. So if I do have a connection with a woman or another person, to me, I'm not really like strict in what that looks like for myself. But it has to be clear and understanding. This is how I understand my life, and this is the vision that I hold for myself, and this is what my ancestors have guided me to. Now we're in connection. I'm grateful for the connection, first and foremost, and I'm happy to pursue whatever this may look like for the time that we have together, but I have no expectation of what that looks like. Mm-hmm. I have no assumption or projection upon you about who you're supposed to be. So if this level of connection is meaningful to you, then we can continue, but if not, then we don't. Mm-hmm. And some people are ready for that, some people are not. And I believe that kind of communication and connection helps lead into intimacy that doesn't look typically like what we think of, you know, from the movies or from the whatever, like media. So I think for men and women or whatever relationship that people choose to be in, no matter what timeline that you're in with this relationship, being clear in your communication first and foremost helps you give that person what they need or want from you, and also you're able to receive that from them too, especially if the relationship matters. If it's a relationship that is really meaningful to you and has helped you, and you believe this is where you want to be, then that communication has to be known. You can't have high expectations of others if you don't hold a certain standard for yourself. If your standard of yourself is really low, then you're going to create expectations or higher standards for others so that you can feel better about yourself, then it's going to be difficult. And what I mean by that, when you have a certain standard, then your behavior matches what that standard is for you. If you believe yourself to be a worthy person and valuable, and that you have gifts to offer, and whoever is with you is lucky to have you, and that's how you feel, and you show up to that, and they feel that too, that's a beautiful relationship. Because they should feel the same about themselves. They should feel that they're worthy and they're valuable and they have gifts to offer, and that you being with them makes them feel good, and that you're lucky to have them. Now the relationship can continue to build and grow and be deeper. But if you don't do that, then there's going to be a lot of disruptions and misalignments, mm-hmm. and it won't be as pono, you know, or won't be pono.
Would you like to tell us an experience about your men's work? What touched you the most?
I have to think, because there's so many. I think one of the bigger ones for me is I had been out here on Maui, and this was before I had really worked with Sacred Sons, and I had my own brotherhood and everything, and I was doing all this work on my own, you know, and going out to land, getting volunteering, and running my own businesses of like bringing people to these places to care for them, like conscious tourism, you know, conscious volunteerism. And then COVID hit and everything just stopped and everything fell off, and the brotherhood I had kind of diminished, and everybody kind of went their separate ways. So I was feeling like, how did this happen? You know, out of my brotherhood, there's only like two guys that I'm really close with still. So I was praying a lot and going through a hard time, you know, just really praying and trying to take care of myself, not knowing how, and going through the ending of my relationship and things like that. So when Sacred Sons had reached out to me, and they knew I was on the island because they were going to have events and gatherings here. And so I was like, oh, okay. I guess I'll come see them. But I had my own judgments, you know, already, because I was coming from where I was at and I see what they do. And I was like, ah, this looks like new agey hippie stuff.
It's all fake. It's all fake.
They're just playing games, you know, like they're just playing. And so I went to this fire circle and I met the founders and a couple other brothers who were helping them putting on these events. And so because of COVID, all that had stopped. So they weren't going to have anything until the next coming like May. And so I had gotten connected with them. I left. I went on a journey with my uncle, who was a Wakonwi Chasha, a medicine man in the Oyate tradition. And I went and traveled with him for about like 3-4 months and doing ceremony and learning. And then I come back to Maui and Sacred Sons is having a gathering here, an event. And I go to it. And I end up teaching and showing and helping a lot. And while I was there, I got to meet my brothers, like my real brothers that from other timelines of our life of ancestral connection and kinship, like I find them at that prime, at that gathering. And one brother, he's not here right now, but he's living in the house with me. He's out in California. We had done a blindfold exercise together. Okay, we had blindfolds on. And so he had no blindfold and he was leading me. And everything that we did was like so playful. We like to fight, so we're doing all of that. And then we led, I led him down to a waterfall here with the blindfold on.
Mm.
And once we get to the waterfall, I start to pray and I chant. And he has his blindfold off and then I tell them the meaning of the chant. It talks about brothers, brotherhood, but the fresh water and the salt water, how the two of them, when they're together, they create life and so much and all these things. And then he's there by the waterfall and he starts crying because his brother had died last year, like his blood brother. And so he felt that prayer and felt that chant. And I don't know why I chanted that way. I don't know why it came out that way, but it did. And it was for him. And so he cried and he healed. And then the last day, we have a circle and we come into connection with each other again. Because I call him out. I was like, oh, I have like a charge against you. There's something I have to say to you that I haven't been able to say. And so we go into the circle and I tell him, when I first saw you, I was intimidated by you because he's a bigger guy. I was like, oh, okay. As a man, I look at other men and I wonder like, okay, how do we match up? And that had happened. And so I told him and he was just like, I felt the same about you. And I was telling him all the things that I did not have that he has. And then he told me all the things that he does not have that I have. And then we just started to cry because there was just so much of that understanding of each other. It was so meaningful to me. And now I have a brother for life.
Wow.
Yeah, we have the same tattoo together. We did so much already. And we've known each other for less than a year. And we've had like entire lives together already. So that was really important to me, is that since I joined Sacred Sons, I found my brothers that I've been asking for and they're here now. So like, that's my relationship.
Yeah.
Is with my brothers. So it's good.
That's such a beautiful story. Thank you so, so much for sharing. So my last question is coming now. If you could change the world, what would you want to change?
Oh my gosh. I don't know. You know, I actually was talking about this yesterday or the other day. I was thinking, you know, there's nothing about the world I want to change.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the world herself is beautiful as she is. And she doesn't need to change at all. She's just fine. More than fine. She's everything. So when I think about what I would want to change is that our relationship as human beings to what we create, the technologies that we create, I want that to change. I want that relationship to change so much. Just because we can doesn't mean we should. And there's been a lot of creation in the technologies that have been helpful, but there's way more that has been very harmful and detrimental. And what I mean by that is like plastic. you know, just because we could create plastic doesn't mean we should, because we weren't thinking about the relationships or the ecology of what this technology was going to disrupt or disturb. And now it's the major cause of, you know, environmental damage across the world. So I look at what's happening now, especially with the technology of like AI and like what we're doing here. I would hope that it would change, that our relationship would become more integral, that the understanding that what we are creating has dramatic effects in collateral damages. So I function in a place of possibilities and consequences. I don't look at things as right or wrong. It's not a polarization like that. It's not like two things confronting each other. No, it's two things like this that they face out and they say, this is the possibility. So if I act this way or behave this way, there will be consequences. And those consequences, whether they're intended or unintended, whatever your intentions are, will have consequences. For example, my intention is I want to build my yoga studio over here in this valley because it's got a beautiful view and everything, and people will love it and they'll come here, and then I'll be able to be successful with my yoga business. There's consequences to that. The consequences, what happens to the land that is there? What are you disrupting? What is it that you are hindering? What cannot grow there anymore? What cannot walk there anymore? What is not allowed there anymore? What are you creating as a boundary that's preventing other life from getting in? So just because you can doesn't mean you should. And then how many yoga studios do we need out here on Maui, really? You know what I mean? And how many people are we trying to invite here to Maui? And how many people are we actually taking care of that live here? So you see, so those are the consequences and the possibilities. The intention is good. It's like, I want to help people. I want to heal people. I want to give them something that they probably haven't had, or a place as a refuge to go to be who they are. Great intentions. However, the consequences still have dramatic effects. And still there's a lot of damages that are being done. So when I look at our relationship to our technologies, that's what I'm asking to change. Why are we not looking at AI as something that benefits the world instead of just us? Like creating AI so that they'll do jobs that we don't want to do? How insane is that? So that's so insane. It's like working is what we need to do in our life, and not working for a job or working for to make a living. I'm saying working with this world, working with these relationships that we have, working with ourselves, you know, inner work, outer work, like all of these things. So why are we not creating AI that will then continue to tend and care for the world around us, right?
Mm-hmm.
Why are we not understanding ourselves more deeply, that whatever this work is that we're doing with technologies is meant to help us spiritually grow, meant to help us internally grow, that we become more integral within ourselves, that we can integrate, rather than the technologies of social media taking us outside of ourselves, and we're so lost in our identities, we're trying to craft one from what we're receiving by other people. And it's like, it's not real. It's all an illusion. So it's like, that's what I would hope to change, is that we as human beings, we're human beings because we can create. We have posable thumbs. We can communicate. We can talk to each other. We know how to make fire. Like, you know, these are some really basic things about ourselves as humans that we take for granted, because we don't have a good relationship with ourselves. So whatever technology that we create is going to be a far cry, a disparity to like who we truly are. And that's what's happening. So, yeah. I mean, I'm not surprised. Like, it's been going on for a long time. But if I could change something, it'd be that.
Great. I know there are now many people inspired of you. Where can people find you?
Oh, yeah.
For sure, in Maui.
Yeah. You can find me at Maui in the jungle. I'm in the jungle.
Yes.
Surprised I have internet connection out here. Yeah, I'm mostly on Instagram. At Kale, K-A-L-E dot Kale Kahi, K-A-A-L-E-K-A-H-I. I do a lot of work with the Sacred Sons, and I'll be working on some projects with them in the meantime. And I also have some things coming up on my own. But just follow me on Instagram, and I pretty much keep people updated over there. But yeah, definitely.
I give all the links to the show notes, and yeah. Mahalo, Kale. Thanks so much for this inspiring interview.
Great. Yeah, thank you, Didi.
Have a fantastic day. I go to bed now because it's late.
Yeah, okay. Have a good rest.
Thank you.
War das ein tolles Interview mit Kale aus Maui. und er hat so viel Wissen und so viel Erfahrung an uns weitergegeben. Und ja, wenn dir dieser Podcast heute gefallen hat, dann gib doch an deine Liebsten auch diesen Podcast weiter, dass sie Teil dessen sein können. Und ich freue mich wie immer über eine positive Bewertung auf iTunes. Wenn du Lust hast, für dich etwas zu tun, schau sehr gerne auf meiner Website vorbei, www.nadinegerhardt.com. Und ja, bis zum nächsten Mal. Ich bin schon selbst ganz gespannt, was da kommt. Ich kann es selbst noch gar nicht sagen. Genieße deinen Tag, genieße deine Woche, trag dich auf Händen und lass es dir gut gehen. Namaste und Satnam, deine Nadine.